The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the April 19th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a big vault. It's golden colored, and it has a seal of the President of the United States on it. Looks like a Democratic donkey in a black T-shirt, and he's doing his best to pick the lock on the vault. The headline is Trump's Secrets, the Democrats' Quest for His Tax Returns, and the Full Mueller Report. And I believe we picked that one up on the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the main story, Trump's Homeland Security Purge. What happened? Frustrated by the continuing surge of Central American migrants at the border, President Trump this week embarked on a dramatic shakeup at the Department of Homeland Security, pushing out Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and other high-ranking officials. Trump reportedly asked Nielsen to submit her resignation after a contentious Oval Office meeting she'd requested in order to plan a way forward at the border. Her ouster came just 2 days after Trump pulled his nomination of Ronald D. Vitiello to lead Immigration and Customs Enforcement, with Trump vowing to find someone tougher. The administration also forced out Claire Grady, DHS's Undersecretary of Management and second in line of succession, to make way for Trump's preferred pick to become acting secretary. Kevin McElnam, the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, will now take the reins at the department, which has 240,000 employees and a $50 billion budget, and is also charged with protecting the U.S. from terrorism. Trump blamed Nielsen for failing to stop the growing influx of Central American asylum seekers, berating her during cabinet meetings and calling her at home in the mornings to demand tougher action at the border. When Nielsen protested that some of the things Trump wanted her to do were illegal, such as simply refusing to hear asylum requests from migrants or reinstituting family separations, Trump became irate. Randolph D. Ailes, director of the Secret Service, will also leave the administration, with more high-profile departures expected. White House aide Stephen Miller, an ardent immigration restructuringist, has reportedly been pressuring the president to replace the departing officials with fellow hardliners. In recent weeks, the president has been ratcheting up his anti-immigration rhetoric. "Our country is full," he said at a Border Patrol station in California. "Can't take you anymore. I'm sorry." What the editorial said: Nielsen deserves no one's pity, said the Washington Post. In attempting to placate a president for whom no anti-immigrant measure is beyond the pale, she presided over a season of gratuitous, inept, and ultimately futile cruelty. Nielsen oversaw and defended the administration's policy of ripping thousands of traumatized children away from their migrant parents, many of whom the government subsequently lost track of. The stain of that policy will long endure. Even more chilling, Trump has decided it wasn't tough enough. Immigration Svengali Stephen Miller got the purge he wanted, said the Wall Street Journal. But what do he and Trump hope to accomplish? Migrants aren't surging over the border because Nielsen wasn't tough. They're coming because America's asylum laws and liberal judges practically invited them here. Congress needs to reform broken policies that allow anyone who sets foot on U.S. soil to claim asylum and then wait here until their claims are heard. At the same time, Miller's close the border restrictionism is a dead end. To solve the crisis at the border, Trump needs to offer a larger immigration vision that combines border security, a legal means for foreign workers to fill U.S. labor needs, and some policy change the Democrats want and will support. Sounding tough accomplishes nothing. Don't blame the president for demanding results, said Jonathan Tobin in the New York Post. Central American migrants are exploiting our laws, and it's the Homeland Security Secretary's job to figure out how to stop them from doing it. Life is undoubtedly hard in countries plagued by extreme poverty and gang violence. But the proposition that everyone living in those nations has a right to live in the United States because it offers them a better life is absurd. Trump should keep firing people until he finds someone willing and able to stop the flood of migrants. Why not just appoint Stephen Miller to run DHS, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Nielsen tried to put a civilized face on Trump's uncivilized policies, only to find out it was impossible to satisfy our deranged president without breaking the law. In the end, even Nielsen had some vestigial loyalty to the Constitution. Trump should have the courage of his racist convictions to give his 33-year-old nativist advisor the formal responsibility for the radical policies he advocates, which include ending birthright citizenship and major cuts to legal immigration. Trump will no doubt find a loyal flunky to carry out his bidding, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. So let's make Nielsen an example of what happens to Trump appointees who just follow orders. She put babies in cages, traumatized children for life, and then appears to have lied to Congress by absurdly insisting there was no family separation policy. Nielsen shouldn't get the kind of plush corporate job or academic post that often go to ex-cabinet officials. By all rights, she should be a pariah. Our controversy of the week: Trump. Should Congress get his tax return? We may be about to solve one of the longest-standing mysteries of the Donald Trump presidency, said David Linhart in the New York Times. Why is Trump so afraid of letting people see his tax returns? Last week, Democratic Representative Richard Neal, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, formally wrote to the Internal Revenue Service requesting Trump's tax returns for the last 6 years. Trump reacted with defiance, reiterating his false claim that an ongoing audit prevents him from releasing his returns, while acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney went further, telling Fox News that Democrats would never see Trump's taxes. The 1924 law cited by Neal is very clear, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. It states that upon written request from the House Ways and Means Chairman, the IRS shall furnish him the returns of any citizen. There are many good reasons for Congress and the public to see Trump's taxes, so that we can find out how, after he went bankrupt, he got hundreds of millions in cash to buy golf courses and other properties, and whether he has been running the executive branch in America's interest or his own. Poor Democrats, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. Crushed by Robert Mueller's failure to end Trump's presidency, they've simply moved on to the next shiny thing, Trump's taxes. But disappointment awaits them here, too. Despite the law cited by Neal, the Supreme Court has ruled that Congress can't investigate people for the sake of exposure, with no legislative purpose. Unless Democrats can find a stronger argument than Orange Man Bad, their request will die in the Supreme Court, which has a majority of conservatives. Neal's stated rationale, that he needs Trump's returns to gauge the effectiveness of routine IRS audits of sitting presidents, is eyewash, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. This is a transparent effort to embarrass the president in the run-up to 2020. So what if Democrats have a political motive, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. They also have a constitutional duty to oversee the executive branch. And there has never in American history been a president for whom it was more important that the public learn the full details of their finances. Trump is clearly desperate to keep his return secret, perhaps because they will reveal evidence of tax fraud, money laundering, financial ties to foreign countries, and other conflicts of interest. Let's not forget Trump repeatedly told voters that he had no business whatsoever with Russia, while secretly pursuing a lucrative deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. By defying Congress, Trump no doubt hopes to trigger a long legal battle that delays the release of his returns until after the 2020 election. Should he win re-election, he could then say, "Hey, suckers, you knew I was a crook when you elected me." Democrats may have the law on their side, said David French in NationalReview.com. But what an awful law it is. Like Trump or loathe him, the realization that Congress can investigate your finances, no matter who you are, for any reason or no reason at all, should be chilling to all Americans. That law has never been abused, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. And respect for the rule of law used to be a sacred Republican value. But here in the age of Trump, we live with two chilling certainties, that this president holds himself above legal accountability and that his party will support him to the hilt. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for Stephen Hawking and Albert Einstein after astronomers used a global network of telescopes to produce the first ever photo of a black hole, providing visual proof that these objects exist. It was a good week for immersive experiences. After the world's first 5D pornographic movie theater opened in Amsterdam. While watching 3D pornography, moviegoers experience the other two advertised dimensions through motion chairs and jets of air and water that the theater owners promise will leave them feeling energized. And it was a good week for capitalism after class warrior Senator Bernie Sanders admitted his soon-to-be-released tax returns will show he's a millionaire who owns three houses. If you write a best-selling book, you can be a millionaire too, Sanders said. But it was a bad week for impatient groundskeeping after parents and players in Ridgefield, Connecticut, tried to dry a wet high school baseball field before a game by dousing it with gasoline and setting it on fire. A hazardous waste firm had to dig up 6 inches of gas-contaminated dirt after the stunt, which a town official said was not a very good idea. It was a bad week for statesmanship after Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte used a campaign rally to boast over and over of being highly equipped with a large penis and describing it in some detail. It was a bad week for Facebook vengeance after a British woman was arrested in Dubai for calling her ex-husband's new wife a horse on Facebook. Layla Shavravish, 55, faces 2 years in prison under the UAE's tough cybercrime laws for commenting on a photo of her ex and his new wife. "Damn you, you left me for this horse." And a short article before we leave this page, why you can't file your taxes at IRS.gov. A bipartisan bill is moving through Congress that would prevent the IRS from creating a free electronic tax filing system. The Taxpayer First Act, which last week passed the House Ways and Means Committee, includes a provision barring the IRS from creating an online system like those offered by H&R Block and Intuit, the company behind TurboTax. Those companies have lobbied for years to block government competition, persuading the IRS to consent to a memorandum of understanding in which private tax prep companies will provide free software to all Americans who earn under $66,000. Of the 70% of taxpayers eligible for this service, however, just 3% use it. This bill would essentially turn that memorandum into federal law. Our briefing page article this week is titled, The World's Largest Election. India is holding general elections over the next 5 weeks. What's at stake? How many can vote? The world's most populous democracy, India, has 900 million eligible voters. The country can't handle all of them voting at once, so they will cast ballots in 7 phases spread over 5 weeks. More than 1 million polling places will be set up. The U.S., by comparison, has about 117,000, partly because of India's vast size and partly because of a law that says no citizen should have to travel more than 1.25 miles to vote. Voters will choose representatives in the Lok Sabha, the lower and more powerful house of the legislature, for 5-year terms, and the party or coalition that holds a majority of the 543 seats will select the prime minister. In the last national election in 2014, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, got an outright majority of seats, the first time in decades a single party has done so. How was his first term? Modi promised sweeping economic reforms to lift farmers out of poverty and to create the 1 million jobs India needs to add every month to accommodate its rapidly growing workforce. He achieved neither. Despite India's relatively good economic growth rate of about 6.6%, agriculture, which employs nearly half the workforce, is growing at just 2.7%. Income inequality is massive, with about 800 million Indians still living in poverty. Modi's government has been accused of trying to hide the unemployment rate, which reached a 45-year high in 2017. When 62 low-level government jobs were posted in Uttar Pradesh state, 93,000 people applied, while a staggering 23 million put in for 90,000 openings at Indian Railways. Modi has, however, succeeded in his other main campaign promise to push Hindutva, or Hindu supremacy, in a land where 20% of the people adhere to Islam, Sikhism, or other religions. What form does Hindutva take? It is the nationalist belief that India is a Hindu nation that should be governed by Hindu values. Modi is an aggressive nationalist who, as governor of Gujarat in 2002, was accused of condoning a pogrom that left more than 1,000 Muslims dead. As prime minister, he continues to belong to Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, RSS, a group that seeks to outlaw all killings of cows, which are sacred to Hindus. Muslims in India are currently allowed to eat beef in most, but not all, states. Modi has frequently accused the opposition Congress party of seeking a pink revolution, a reference to blood from slaughterhouses, and called it the party of Muslims. Modi has also spent millions on public works to glorify Hindu heroes and downplayed tourism to sites dating from the Muslim Mughal era, including the Taj Mahal. What is he running on this time? With the economy not living up to Modi's promises, the government is promoting nationalist pride and fear of Pakistan. India last month entered the elite club of countries equipped to wage war in space when it blew up one of its satellites with a ballistic missile. Modi has also benefited from a surge in patriotism after the recent skirmish with Pakistan over divided Kashmir. In February, a suicide bomber from the Pakistan-based terrorist group Jaish-e-Mohammed killed 40 Indian paramilitary troops, and Modi responded with stern rhetoric and airstrikes in Pakistani territory. He has taken to smearing the opposition as pro-Pakistan, saying, "In hating Modi, the opposition has begun to hate the nation." Who is Modi running against? The main opposition is the Secular Congress Party, controlled by the Nehru Gandhi family. Rahul Gandhi, no relation to Mahatma, is the great-grandson of Indian founding father Jawaharlal Nehru. His grandmother and father were also prime ministers. He is promising a basic income of about $1,000 a year, as well as programs to empower women. Polls show Modi leading, but Gandhi could still pull an upset. The BJP lost three major state elections in the Hindi heartland in December, a reflection of voter dissatisfaction with the economy. Still, while the two main parties dominate, about half of all Indian voters will likely cast ballots for regional parties specific to their state, many of them based on caste or ethnicity. With the stakes high, all sides have resorted to unprecedented propaganda efforts, including pushing fake stories on social media. What kind of propaganda? Facebook said it had taken down more than 1,100 accounts, nearly 700 of them linked to Congress, that were spreading disinformation, including one faked video of a BJP official purportedly conspiring to gin up a war to boost election chances. "The magnitude of the problem is really huge," said analyst Kanchan Kaur, "but the BJP isn't innocent either." HuffPost India found that the party had evaded Facebook and WhatsApp funding disclosure rules to secretly back sites that run doctored videos slandering Congress leaders. For the 290 million Indian adults who are illiterate, these videos, as well as Bollywood movies, are a main source of information about candidates. Voting ends May 19th, and the results will be announced May 23rd. "In the meantime," said Apar Gupta of the Internet Freedom Foundation, "millions of voters are waking up to fake news, propaganda, and hate speech inciting violence against Muslims and other minorities every day." Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with one from the U.S. Hal Brands at Bloomberg.com writes, "NATO's role in the 21st century." "At age 70, NATO is the most successful alliance in history," said Hal Brands. "But while President Trump is profoundly wrong to view NATO as an anachronism, the alliance does have to turn its attention to new and dangerous threats. the clash between liberalism and autocracy. Russia and China see the West's liberal values as an existential threat to their regimes and believe they'll be more secure and successful in a world where democracy has been weakened and autocracy is prevalent. So they seek to sow chaos in democratic countries. Moscow interferes with elections in the U.S., Europe, and Latin America, while Beijing is spending hundreds of billions on influence operations in Indonesia, Africa, Australia, and Eastern Europe. To combat the onslaught of cyber war, election interference, and corruption, NATO must mount a strong defense that is coordinated with other non-NATO democracies. This could involve naming and shaming, economic sanctions, and intelligence sharing, including an exchange of best practices for responding to information warfare. A global defense against autocracy requires strong American leadership, not a White House that treats democracy, promotion, and human rights as mere distractions. This comes from New Zealand. My hometown of Christchurch has become synonymous with terrorism since the massacre of 50 Muslims last month by an Australian white supremacist, said actor Sam Neill. But my hometown has also become synonymous with compassion, tolerance, solidarity, community bravery, and hope. The outpouring of goodwill toward our Muslim and immigrant neighbors after the tragedy showed that these are our true values. When I was a child attending services at Christ Church Cathedral, the city was mostly white and mostly Anglican, and the cathedral's location at the city center reflected that. The church was largely destroyed by an earthquake in 2011, and there is now talk of rebuilding it. That would be a mistake. The too small, too pedestrian pile of Victorian Gothic was originally built as a symbol of the hierarchical structure that was deliberately imported from Great Britain, class by class. Why would we seek to replicate that hidebound tradition in the middle of a now multicultural, more secular city? Christchurch residents deserve an arts and community center, somewhere without any particular creed, and that embraces all our cultures. Somewhere to meet, to sing, to talk, to be quiet, to debate, to laugh, to perform, to get to know one another, to listen. Such a spot would cost far less and mean so much more. And this from the United Kingdom. May will be remembered as a traitor. Prime Minister Theresa May's betrayal of Brexit will lead her to be ranked alongside the worst eels in Western history, said Quentin Letts. In the past, when trying to describe moral collapse, we would invoke the name of Vidkun Quisling, the Norwegian politician who betrayed his nation to Nazi Germany, or Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister who sold out the Czechs to Hitler. Now we'll point to May as the embodiment of cowardice. May voted in favor of Britain remaining in the European Union in the 2016 referendum, but after taking office, a month later promised that Brexit means Brexit, and that no deal is better than a bad deal. It was all a lie. She negotiated a divorce deal with Brussels that would keep post-Brexit Britain tied closely to the EU for years to come. And when that pact failed three times in Parliament, she collapsed like overwatered jelly. Having succumbed to the alarmist predictions of those who claim leaving without a trade pact will cause chaos at our borders and shortages of food and medicine, May has now ruled out a no-deal separation. Worse, she is working on a compromise deal with the terrorist-supporting, Russia-loving, commie opposition labor leader Jeremy Corbyn. Lips will curl at her very name for decades to come. As we spit on her memory, we will call her traitor, and she will deserve it. Time for The Last Word, our in-depth article. The title this week is The Deported Americans. About 600,000 American-born children are enrolled in Mexico's schools, said journalist Brooke Jarvis in the California Sunday magazine. These other dreamers often struggle to build a new life across the border. The school day at Escuela Secundaria, Tecnuno Número 26, starts early. As the first rays of sunshine make their way over the foothills of Popocatépetl volcano in Central America, the narrow streets fill with students in ones and twos and little laughing groups. Ashley Mantilla's day starts earlier than most. On a Monday last June, long before the sun rose, the 15-year-old left the small cinder block house she shares with her sister, brother, and parents. She walked past the lime trees under which the family entertains guests, past the outhouse and the thin horse tied up next to her grandparents' home, to the road that winds by a deep ravine, and into the center of her small town, perched high in the ridges below the volcano. There she waited for a minibus that would drive her half an hour to Número 26. It's not a cheap trip to make every day, and her parents are willing to pay for it, not because they have extra money, but because they think it's a better option than the local school. There are real teachers there instead of video lessons, and specialty classes including coding in addition to agriculture, food preservation, and beekeeping. At 7:30, the school's courtyard was packed with teenagers. They lined up in straight rows and placed their hands across their chest as the Mexican national anthem played on a loudspeaker. Ashley had PE that day, so she had her dark hair pulled back and was wearing her gym uniform, track pants and a polo shirt embroidered with the words Niños Héroes, or Heroic Children, a group of historical figures that the school honors as a kind of mascot. The heroes were six military cadets, the youngest of them 13, who died defending a castle in Mexico City from American invaders in 1847. It was, in other words, a long way from the school days Ashley used to experience back when she was an American student, growing up in an American town and studying in an American public school. In those days, her father Felix worked as a cook in a restaurant and did maintenance on swimming pools. Her older sister, Leslie, earned a much-treasured certificate of academic excellence with President Barack Obama's signature on it. They studied the history of South Carolina, their home state. They ate turkey on Thanksgiving and built snowmen in the winter. Sometimes classmates bullied Ashley, telling her to go back to Mexico. But their taunts mostly confused her. "I don't know Mexico," she would say. "I'm from here." In 2011, South Carolina's then-governor, Nikki Haley, signed what was known as Show Me Your Papers Law, modeled on Arizona's infamous SB 1070, which allowed police to turn routine traffic stops into immigration checkpoints. Ashley's parents began to feel anxious. They thought of what had happened a few years before when a South Carolina poultry plant was raided and many of its workers deported without their children. "What happens if they separate us?" wondered Bernice, Ashley's mother. "We were thinking of the good of the family." They decided it was time to move their three children, Leslie, 12, Ashley, 9, and Angel, 5, all American-born citizens, from the only home they knew. In the jargon of immigration, the family was planning to return migrate. But the kids could hardly return to a place where they had never been. They were just leaving. The flight from Charlotte, North Carolina, landed in Mexico City 2 months after the new immigration law went into effect. The family took a series of buses away from the city toward the tiny community where the children's parents and grandparents had all grown up. stores, and highways dropped away as they climbed higher. The buses passed adobe brick buildings with tin roofs and donkeys carrying loads of wood. Oh my gosh, Ashley thought, are we going to live here? When her new classmates told Ashley that she didn't belong, she refused to cry in front of them. When she arrived home, though, the tears flowed. It wasn't an easy thing to hear, but that didn't mean she didn't agree with them. Ashley is one of 600,000 American-born children who are believed to be enrolled in K-12 schools across Mexico. Together, these American children now make up 3% of all students in Mexico, though the concentrations vary. In some municipalities where migration is particularly common, 1 in 10 students is American. Many families, especially if they were deported unexpectedly, have trouble assembling and authenticating all the various documents that are needed to enroll, which means that kids end up missing months or even years of instruction. Like Ashley, American students in Mexico frequently end up in rural schools, the ones with the fewest resources to help them. Theirs is a new and unique generation, one that academics are only beginning to name. The students we share, a phrase meant to encompass transnational students living on both sides of the border, reflects the hope that the two countries will develop better support for students who researchers broadly agree are being failed educationally. Researchers I spoke to also used American Mexicans, the other dreamers, and los invisibles, the invisible ones. Children from forced cross-border families, offered Maria Dolores Perez Pombo, who teaches sociology at Colegio de la Frontera Norte. The problem of being unable to adapt to Mexico or belong to the U.S., it's a generation that was left in between. Ashley failed her first year of school in Mexico. It was a painful blow to a girl who had always pushed herself to succeed. But she said her teacher had no patience for giving extra help to a third grader who couldn't read Spanish. He seemed to think she was stupid or lazy. It took 2 years for most of the teasing to drop off. By then, both Ashley's Spanish and her cultural fluency had improved. Eventually, she was at the top of her class again. She realized that one reason the other students had disliked her so much was because they had assumed that she would be racist and elitist toward them. "I am an American," she protested, "but I'm not the type they think." At some point, without noticing, she began dreaming in Spanish instead of English. But even as English dropped out of their daily lives, the sisters kept speaking it between themselves. It was both a comfort and a fragile connection to a future that they feared losing. Today, when Ashley makes a grammatical mistake or forgets an English word, Leslie instantly and firmly corrects her. When Leslie started at the small local middle school, where classes took the form of government-produced instructional videos, she became a stand-in teacher of other students. An educational workshop, growing flowers and peaches to make money for the school, seemed to simply be work. Many parents and their children weren't concerned. Work in the outlying fields is the main future awaiting boys in the mountain towns, and girls often drop out as young as 14 or 15 to marry and have children. The sisters and their parents had different ideas about education. The girls wanted to go to university someday. They wanted to keep open the option of returning to the United States to study and to work. Leslie began commuting to a larger school. Ashley, when she reached seventh grade, followed. As the years passed, Ashley and Leslie found it more complicated to define who they were or where they belonged. "Sometimes when people ask me where I'm from," said Leslie, "I don't know how to respond." One of the things that makes Leslie feel most American is the history she learned in school. Knowing a place's past, she believes, is part of what makes you belong there. Occasionally, she likes to get her U.S. passport out of its safekeeping spot. The words to the preamble to the Constitution, which she memorized long ago for a class project back in South Carolina, are written inside. "Sometimes I just want to read it," she said, "and remind myself that I'm from over there, too." When Ashley arrived in Mexico, she identified as fully American. Right now, she told me, it's half and half. In part, that's because she appreciates aspects of both places. But it's also a reflection of not feeling fully welcome in either. When Ashley was chosen to carry the Mexican flag at Numero 26's morning ceremony, other students told her she had no right. When she asked an old friend in South Carolina how her parents had voted in the 2016 presidential election, the friend didn't want to tell her. Another friend said she no longer wanted Ashley to come back to the U.S. In early 2017, Bryant Jensen, a professor and educational researcher at Brigham Young University, visited Escuela Secundaria Técnica Número 26. He was looking for participants in a study about the educational well-being of American-born children in Mexico. At first, he recalls, the director of the school told him, "No tenemos esos estudiantes aquí." We don't have that kind of student here. But another staff member in the office spoke up. She could think of a couple of kids. Those students, it turned out, could think of a few more. Jensen quickly had 17 names on his list. Some of the students walked into the office and introduced themselves to Jensen in perfect English. Others had forgotten the language or moved before they had a chance to really learn it. Many had been unaware that the others, even those in the same grade, shared their background. They'd come from Oklahoma, Tennessee, California, and New York. One student, a boy named Leo Gutierrez Rojas, was a grade above Ashley. He had grown up in Virginia, where his parents worked a variety of jobs, at a furniture factory, a sausage factory, an Elizabeth Arden packaging plant, a Cisco distribution center. When he was 3, Leo's father was in a car accident and ended up in prison for 3 years. Though the family never understood whether he was in trouble for the accident or his immigration status. Leo's father was finally deported when Leo was 6, and Leo and his mother, Leticia, followed him to Mexico. Leo was so young that he had little understanding of what had changed. He cried for weeks and kept asking to be taken to the park they used to visit in Virginia, to a friend's house there, to McDonald's. Determined to fit in at school, he vowed he wouldn't speak English, not even when his dad tried to practice with him. Now he no longer remembers it, though he has a better accent than the other kids in his English class. At home, Leo is gregarious, flamboyant, funny, but at school he stays quiet. He loves to study math and science and dreams of a career in robotics. But the school placed him in the agriculture program. Leo told me he now thinks of himself as a Mexican who is one part American. "Because you have a passport," said Leticia. "Because I eat pizza," Leo replied. His mom thinks he will return to the United States when he's older to look for work. For now, though, that's hard for Leo to imagine. "I don't know anyone. I don't know where to go. I don't know pounds, ounces, miles. I don't know how to buy a hamburger." He turned to his mother. "Does Wendy's still exist? Did I eat there? Did I like it?" When Leo watched the movie Rio about a bird that spends too much time in confinement and is unable to fly when it returns to its natural habitat, it reminded him of himself. "Creo que así soy yo," he said. "I think that I am like that." Researchers worry that he is right, that children who hope to return to their home country may be unprepared to do so. Jensen put it succinctly, "Though the border may temporarily split lives in two, there's no such thing as a half-citizen." One day when I visited Leo's house, he was studying for a test in English class. I offered to quiz him. The test was on verb conjugations, and one of the words was estar. At first, Leo couldn't remember how to translate it, but then the answers came back to him, and he repeated the conjugations in deliberate voice with an American accent. I was, he said. I am. I will be. This was adapted from an article that first appeared in the California Sunday magazine. We'll read a couple of the articles on the health and science page, starting with the woman who feels no pain. Scientists have identified a rare genetic mutation that has allowed a 71-year-old Scottish woman to live a life virtually free of pain, fear, and anxiety, a discovery that could one day lead to new treatments for chronic pain. Doctors realized about 5 years ago that retired school teacher Jo Cameron was unusual after she refused painkillers following a major hand operation, reports the New York Times. Follow-up questions revealed that cuts, burns, and fractures didn't hurt her. When she broke her arm at age 9, she went to the hospital 3 days later, only because her mother told her it looked strange. She felt no pain during childbirth, likening the experience to a tickle, and cannot recall ever feeling depressed or scared. Her body also heals faster than other people's. It didn't dawn on me that I was different, she says. I thought it was just me. When scientists at University College London examined Cameron's DNA, they found two notable gene mutations. The first dampens activity in a gene called FAAH, which makes an enzyme that breaks down a chemical crucial to pain sensation and mood. The second, rare mutation, is on a previously unknown gene that researchers named FAAH-OUT. Scientists believe when the gene is disabled, as it is in Cameron, it makes an FAAH fall silent. The researchers are now examining how FAAH-OUT works, with the hope of developing a gene therapy or other pain treatment around it. The day the dinosaurs died. Paleontologists have discovered an extraordinary trove of fossils that appears to capture the moments after an asteroid slammed into Earth some 66 million years ago, dooming the dinosaurs to extinction. When the 7.5-mile-wide asteroid smashed into what is now the Gulf of Mexico, it ripped a hole in the Earth's crust some 50 miles wide and 18 miles deep. Mega earthquakes and colossal tsunamis rippled out from the impact site, and billions of tons of molten rock was hurled into the sky and across thousands of miles. That debris fell back to Earth as tiny globs of glass known as tektites, reports NationalGeographic.com, in a pulverizing rain that lasted for 45 minutes. The new excavation site near Bowman, North Dakota, is full of fossils of sea creatures that were swept inland by giant waves, tangled together with a mass of trees, flowers, and land-inhibiting vertebrates. The gills of fish at the site are clogged with tektites. The cataclysm essentially stockpiled the rarest and most poorly represented things in the rock formation in one deposit that we can study for decades, said Robert De Palma, the paleontologist who found the fossil bed. He says the site also contains dinosaur fossils, which he will examine in further studies. And we're on the Talking Points page. We'll start with leggings too revealing? The stretchy, form-fitting tights, now regularly worn by millions of American women, have again made the leap from garment to cultural lightning rod, said Vanessa Friedman in the New York Times. This time, a self-described Catholic mother of four sons named Marianne White triggered the furor by writing a letter to the University of Notre Dame school newspaper complaining about sitting with her four sons at Mass behind a row of snugly swaddled women's derrieres. Leggings are so naked, so form-fitting, so exposing, White wrote. Could you think of the mothers of sons the next time you go shopping? Predictably, a firestorm of protest followed, with more than 1,000 Notre Dame students wearing leggings to class. Supporters as far away as France posted legging selfies to Twitter in solidarity with the oppressed. This debate has erupted periodically for decades, said Caitlin Tiffany in Vox.com. But as leggings have become a standard in young women's wardrobes, worn to work, school, and nearly everywhere, the backlash has become more intense. Some high schools have banned them, with one North Dakota assistant principal citing Pretty Woman as proof that leggings are a common uniform for sex workers. A Montana state representative lobbied to make yoga pants, as leggings are sometimes called, illegal in public. In 2017, two leggings-clad teens were booted from a United Airlines flight for indecency. The backlash is all about men and prudish women policing women's bodies, said Ara Madawi in The Guardian. How ironic that the West bemoans the repression of Muslim women who wear the veil by relying on the same misogynistic argument. Why should men be forced to reckon with the sexual desire engendered by seeing the female form? As a former teenage boy myself, said David Von Drell in the Washington Post, I'd like to point out that they'll think about sex no matter what women wear. Perhaps my daughter put it best. If some boy can't handle my clothing choices, that's his problem. Yes, but men are very visual and easily aroused creatures, said Suzanne Venker in WashingtonExaminer.com. Women are entitled to display their buttocks and nether regions in form-fitting spandex, but they shouldn't act offended when men notice. If women don't want to be sexualized, they need to stop sexualizing themselves. Wind power. Why Trump hates turbines. Like another character named Don, President Donald Trump is tilting at windmills, said Michael Biesecker and Associated Press. In recent weeks, the president has repeatedly, like the fictional Don Quixote, mistaken a benign device for turning the wind into energy for something monstrous. At rallies and in speeches, Trump has falsely claimed that wind turbines diminish nearby property values by 75%, and nonsensically warned that if they're used to generate electricity, TVs won't work during calm weather. Turn off the television, darling, please, he sarcastically said. There's no wind. Last week, Trump claimed the noise from wind farms causes cancer. He also said the turbines slaughter birds, all while spinning his arms like a turbine and making an unpleasant whirring sound. Trump is parroting a grab bag of debunked claims promoted by the fossil fuel industry, said Dan Vergano in BuzzFeedNews.com. Studies have found no conclusive evidence that wind turbine noise causes any health problems. Wind farms do kill about 500,000 birds a year, but cars and power lines kill 600 million, and cats kill more than 2 billion. And, of course, wind energy is integrated into a power grid that has other sources, so there's no danger of TV blackout on calm days. So why does Trump hate wind turbines? Trump's base wishes we could go back to the 1950s, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times, So they love it when he mocks hippy-dippy, unmanly things like wind and solar power, because the coal mining and oil industries lavishly donate to the GOP. The sad irony is that coal, unlike wind, fills the atmosphere with pollutants that damage the heart and lungs and actually does cause cancer. Trump's feud with wind farms is also personal, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. In 2006, he bought land on the coast of Scotland to build a golf course and became embroiled in a prolonged and ultimately unsuccessful battle against a planned wind farm off the coast that he felt would spoil the views for his golfers. For years, Trump embraced and tweeted any negative information about wind turbines with breathless pseudo-concern about their effects. In a happy coincidence for him, his grudge against wind power now overlaps with the policy agenda of the Republican Party. And we have one short note that follows on the theme of President Trump. President Trump's penchant for making false or misleading statements is accelerating. Trump averaged nearly 5.9 false or misleading claims a day in his first year in office. He hit nearly 16.5 a day in his second year. So far in 2019, he's averaging nearly 22 false or misleading claims a day. And we'll finish with a quote from poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who says, "Poetry is news from the frontiers of consciousness." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.